blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Everybody wants to subtract my blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Blackness, 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 blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Everybody wants to subtract my blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Blackness, blackness, blackness.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Other Experience. It's your host, Just JB, and today we have an amazing guest. He is a content strategist extraordinaire. He is a mentor. He is a filmmaker. David Dylan Thomas, how you doing, man?
Good. How you been, man?
I've been good, man. I'm very excited for this episode and excited that to have you on and excited to, you know, just get into this conversation. And, you know, it's an honor to have you on, man.
I've been good. And thank you for having me on this podcast. As soon as you told me the idea, I'm like, he doesn't know it yet, but he's got his first guest. Like,
Yeah, this podcast is about navigating Black identity and non-stereotypical Blackness and all the stories that come with that. And, you know, I just ask questions about that to guests, and I let guests just kind of tell their story. So I guess we'll just get to it. Can you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and your upbringing?
Sure. So, David Dylan Thomas, author, speaker, former content strategist and UX person, and filmmaker, my whole life, actually filmmaker. I guess it's as good as a place to start as any. So my upbringing, my background is I was born in Columbia, Maryland, 1974, just turned 50. And, so I didn't know my dad. My mom and dad had split up shortly after I was born. There's a whole story there, so I didn't really get to know him. So the role models I had growing up, were sort of like, the male role models I had grown up were really like these like white action heroes. Like I grew up watching like Raiders of the Lost Ark movies and James Bond and Lethal Weapon, Star Wars, right? So like Harrison Ford, Mel Gibson, you know, Roger Classics. Moore, right? So these are like my specimens of manhood, right? Like this is what it means to be a man. I didn't really have, other than like Eddie Murphy, kinda, I didn't really have a lot of like Black role models, you know what I mean? Like male role models. And my mom was sort of interesting in that. So I give my mom a lot of credit because she was, you know, a proud Black woman, and she did a few things for me. One, she gave me kind of unconditional love. She just made it clear no matter what happened, she loved me. Two, she insisted and went into debt to make sure I got a good education. So she did all that for me. And she made it clear that I could be whatever I wanted to be. And I think the flip side of that, and this is kind of where like, my journey with Blackness comes in, is that for her, at least as she was raising me, Blackness wasn't so much an issue, something she wanted to highlight necessarily in my education or in my identity. I think she was coming in more from an angle of like, no matter what, you can be whatever you want to be. And hidden in that no matter what was like the fact that I'm Black isn't meant to be an issue. I think, and this is me theorizing, she passed away in 2011, but my theorizing is really, it was more around, she didn't want me to think of that as something that would limit me. Right. And so she didn't really emphasize it. So as I grew up, I wasn't really so much focusing in any way or being highly literate in any kind of like Black culture, African culture, any of that stuff. Now, ironically, my dad is from Ethiopia. And when I finally did meet him when I was 25 years old, I started learning more about this whole other culture that was a part of my identity I didn't even know about. But really growing up, it was more about a white identity. And I don't, when I say that, I mean like white is the default culture in America, and it was as I was growing up. So as a result, the culture I had was default culture. It was white culture. It was like, this is the music I listen to, like rock music and grunge. I wasn't really listening to rap. I feel like I missed out on like the 90s rap scene, and I'm only rediscovering it now in my 50s or late 40s and 50s. It's like, oh my God, like G-Unit and fucking Mobb Deep and like all these fucking things. Like, it's like, this is amazing. Where was this stuff when I was, you know, growing up?
Right.
Gangstar. Oh my God. Like Luke Cage and Gangstar, like all that, like there's just this revelation. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but that's a rediscovery I'm making now. And a lot of that I came into my blackness much later in life and was sort of like in living in this kind of assimilated space growing up. And as a result, my first encounter, I always like to ask people this, and I might ask you this if you're cool with it, but I always liked, when I talk to black folks, I always sort of like wonder or like to ask them, like, when did you learn you were black? And for me, ironically, it wasn't because some white person discriminating against me. It was because this is like maybe second, third grade. I was like playing in the recess or whatever. And one of the other black kids, mostly black school, one of the other black kids like basically said, why do you talk white? Right. Because I talk then like I talk now, which is fairly flat, almost Midwestern. Right. Mm-hmm. Like just very flat accent. Right. Right. And by him saying, why do you talk white? That's when I realized, oh, I must be black. Because if I were white, it wouldn't be weird for me to talk white now, would it? Right.
Right.
And again, that was part of my mother's insistence on education and diction. Like, I feel like that kind of flowed into that. I think she would have been angry if I was talking too black. Right. But yeah, like, but to me, this is just how I talk. Like, what are you talking about? Like, this is how I talk. So that, all of that to say, like, that has been like the big arc of my journey has been this, like, growing up white and discovering my blackness much later in life when I was kind of more free to make my own decisions.
That is quite the unique and amazing pathway. So let's unpack a little bit what you just said. So first off, to answer your question to me, I'm going to guess it was just when I was younger, my mom was very, my mom and dad, but especially my mom was very adamant about, learning, and being knowledgeable of black culture, especially being black and growing up in the burbs and being in a, suburban landscape and everything like that, and going to a school with a lot of white people. But like there were times at school, I think I was like really young. I was probably like, my mom told me this. I was like, and she passed away back in 2017. So, you know, big ups to the moms. Yeah, man. Thank you. But yeah, I probably felt like self-conscious or something like that in school when I first was at school or something like that. I probably like was, you know, upset about being the only, being one of the only like black people there. I was probably like crying to my mom. I'm paraphrasing. This is years ago, but that's probably when I was like really realizing about, you know, about all that and all that stuff. But yeah, man. When you're told it's funny being told, you know, you talk white and everything like that, because obviously I experienced that too. And when you heard that then in that moment, if you can remember, you know, how did you feel and how did it like really connect with you versus and transpose that into you evolving as a black man, as a black teen, as an adult through your life?
Yeah.
And hearing that and I don't want to say coming to grips, but adapting to those nuances and those, the way people, you know, engage with you in regards to that. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. And I feel like I hung on to that as a part of my identity for a really long time, because I think that whiteness or perceived whiteness intersected with me being a black geek too. Because I was into like Doctor Who and science fiction, which I also inherited from my mom. She was very into sci-fi. She introduced me to Star Trek. She read all those like sci-fi novels with all the really cool covers from like the 60s and 70s. And
classic.
So that, and again, I give her props for that, making me that as well. But I think that I wasn't into the things a young black boy was supposed to be into, right? I wasn't into sports. I wasn't into soul music or rap or anything like that. I was into like Doctor Who and white shit and geek shit, right? Mm-hmm. And I was really smart, right? I did third and fourth grade in the same year. That didn't make me any friends.
Whoa.
Right?
That's badass, man. What? That's amazing.
So this runs in my family, I've learned. Like, I'm thankful for this. My dad kind of accelerated through his schooling. My son is also very accelerated with his. Like, we're smart. My mom was super smart. My wife is super smart. Like, everybody, like my family overall is sort of blessed with just knowledge, I guess. But yeah, so I was really smart kid. like Reddit at an early age, all that stuff, like what they call gifted now. But but in any case, like that didn't win me any friends, right? And again, that's not what black kids are supposed to be, right? Like I was like, so you ever watch Undercover Brother?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Movie. So I was Smart Brother, right? I was Smart Brother. And we didn't have a lot of like role models, especially then, for a black nerd. We didn't, the first one we got was Urkel, and that was in the 90s, right?
Yep.
Or maybe Carlton, you know? And like, you don't really get respect for that until much later, right? Now we got like Wakanda just full of black smart people, man. We got a whole country full of smart black people, right? And that's cool, right? But not then, brother. And that's the thing. Man. I think there's an accusation when you are young, smart, and black in the 80s that you are trying to be white. You are trying to be something better than you are. Like it's this is a trope in any ethnicity, truly, especially when it comes to class, but it's like, you think you're better than us, right? That note, that trope, I think that's what being a nerdy black kid runs afoul of when you're trying to make friends in high school or grade school or whatever.
You know, it's amazing that you mentioned that, and that with you saying, I'm going to harp on or key in on, you know, the viewpoint of other black individuals thinking like, oh, you're better than us. I like to ask people, and I love to ask guests if there's any, you know, any insight as to, I wonder like why we do that, why we treat each other this way. And I wonder with what you just said, I wonder if there's some subliminal notes there or some type of programming. I don't know. You know what I'm trying to say? Mm-hmm. That, you know, like I'm not like, and I'm saying this as a, I'm saying this from a human level, class level, race level, like layered, just layered right here.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, you don't talk like me. You don't talk like us. You're not from where I'm from. Therefore, you like just those assumptions and everything like that. And, you know, do you think that plays a part into maybe why this happens, especially, you know, from the black perspective in our community?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it goes back to the, oh man. All right. I have to ask a question here and you can cut this if you need to.
Oh, sure.
Are we allowed to say the N-word on this podcast?
Yeah.
All right. I think it goes back to the house nigger and the field nigger.
Okay.
100. Right. Because when you are a subjugated class, and there ain't no subjugated class where they don't give you castes to keep you down, because we need you. If I'm going to oppress you, my best bet is to keep you fighting amongst yourselves. And the best way for me to do that is to give one group a little bit better vittles than the other group. And I can guarantee you two are going to be fighting. You're not going to bother with me. Right. You're just going to be yelling at the house nigger. So I think it's just that. You know, 1,000 years later, we're still fighting over that. Oh, you're trying to be an overseer. I see how it is. Right.
Right.
So anytime you're a group that's being oppressed, you consolidate. You can't trust people who might betray you. Right. So we do this, right? We do this with brothers who are misstepping, right? We do this, and I think we do it legitimately with like Clarence Thomas. It's like that brother ain't for us. He ain't trying to help us.
Right.
He got his affirmative action and he closed that door behind him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now he's hanging out with Harlan Crow or whatever. Right.
Right. Right.
But if he didn't give any of that to us, we don't. So when you are subjugated, when you are looking out for yourselves, you can't, you got to know who you can trust. It's dangerous to keep folks like me around if we think we can't trust you. Like that's the most generous version of this. It's like, it's a safety measure to, I mean, again, another very loaded word I'm going to use here is coon, right? Mm-hmm. We invent that word so that we can point out, don't trust that brother there. He ain't one of us. He ain't with us. He's going to spy on us. He's a cop. he a canary, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think that's the most sincere place that that's coming from. If I'm going to be generous and say, this is a trauma response. This is a self-defense response. So I'm not happy they were calling me a house nigger, but I get it.
Right. Right. And you know, it's crazy. It's so, it's layered generationally. It really touches upon generations and subliminal programming, outright programming. And it's, you know, I feel like it's sad, and that's part of the reason I wanted to, you know, just engage with other people in the community and other guests such as yourself to kind of, you know, just share stories and just kind of maybe even unpack why this happened. So it's interesting, like because I'm going to be honest with you, like, something I've had to do for myself in this is, like, as being the host, you know, I'm sure you can, you know, that's probably why you're on the show. I have wondered for years how to address this. I put it in my art. Let me see if, you know, well, you see the guitar in the back, the guitar case in the back. I put it in music. I have written about it. I've spoken about it. I try to gather people about it. It is something that has fascinated me throughout my life. And it really poured on for me, you know, in probably my late, really, really poured on, as in, like, I noticed it happening in volume around my my teens and 20s and everything like that, especially late high school into college and everything like that. So, but enough about me. Just I'm going to rope that back to you. Those responses started, you know, your awakening with, like, oh, I guess I'm Black. What happened when you were younger? as you grew up, was there any moments where it increased in volume to you, or is it just kind of like been sporadic in different points of your life?
So I think it's interesting. I think that as I, you know, moved up in the world and moved on in the world, because what was sort of happening at the same time was I was ever so subtly moving up in class. And again, that was a, like, brute force effort by my mom to make sure that I got into, like, the best schools. She got me into Friends School of Baltimore, which is one of the best schools out there, right? But a mostly white school. And so I assimilated, right? And I was out there and I was a musician, but I was singing, like, white music. I mean, white music that used to be Black. I was singing rock and roll, right?
Right.
So, like, Satisfaction, Led Zeppelin, all the stuff, U2. Mm-hmm. And unaware of, or only tangentially aware of, the politics of any of that. That mm-hmm. doesn't come till later for me. It's just, mm-hmm. oh, here's some bands I love. And I wasn't doing it to fit in, quote unquote, any more than anyone does anything in high school to fit in. I was doing it because I wanted to express myself. And I had all these, like, emotions. Like, I was a depressed kid, right? I was even a suicidal kid. So I was dealing with that too. And I wasn't diagnosed with depression until, like, literally my 40s, but I'm very certain I was dealing with it then, before we had a name for it. So all of that became expressed through art. So making movies, making music, writing, like, all these ways to express myself, and all in the mantle of being a nerd still. Like, I hung out with the nerds. I was in the little nerd clique. It was a very cliquey school. And I had some friends kind of outside of that, but it wasn't really, like, I wasn't what I would deem a popular kid. And it's so funny looking back on all of that, because it was all so meaningless. I was depressed over nothing when mm-hmm. it came to all that. And I don't regret it necessarily, because it made me who I am, but it's just sort of like, oh my God, if I could go back, I would be like, I know you're not going to listen to me, but chill the fuck out, kid. but all of that. So all of that relationally to my blackness, it's not even called to my whiteness, because that's what it was, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't really register in that way. Like, and again, also during this time, my family got born again, and we spent, I'd say, equal time in white and Black churches. Okay. So there's a very different churches, right? So there's a downtown York Road Black church. My mother was really good friends with the pastor there. She ended up becoming a pastor later. And that's just a very traditional Black church, right? Laying on of hands, people, like, passing out and, like, mm-hmm. all that stuff. but also we would go to, and later we would go to more frequently, this suburban church that's more like one of those mega churches. I mean, it wasn't that big, but it's the sort of a micro version of the same thing. Super evangelical, right? And much more white, but still in that kind of, like, that like, you know, Georgia megachurch kind of vibe, and very much like into those preachers like Kenneth Copeland and Creflo Dollar, right? Like this very kind of like evangelical laying on of hands, you know, speaking in tongues, speaking things into reality thing, which, as an aside, when I look at what's happening to MAGA right now. I'm like, oh, clock that. Yep, we were doing that in the 80s. Yep, I didn't think this would actually ever see the light of day, but I know, I see you. I see you,
right?
Anyway, but I think that was also kind of like divorced of whiteness, because again, it was just the default. This is just what we did. And while I could visibly be like, this is a blacker church, this is a whiter church, I found myself more comfortable in the whiter spaces, right? Because that's what was normalized. That's what I was seeing every day when I went to school. That's what I was seeing on TV. I already knew I wanted to be a movie director, and all the movie directors I knew were white, right? White men, right? So I wanted to be a white man. Like, I wouldn't have put it in those terms, but in the way I dressed and the way I talked and the way I like, and my idols, the pictures I put on my wall, all white dudes, right? I wanted to be Sting. I wanted to be Bono, right? I wanted to be Steven Spielberg, right? So all of that, again, if you had sat me down and been like, hey, isn't it weird that all the people you want to be are white? I would have been like, oh, what is it? What? I'm colorblind, right? I'm not black. I'm OJ, right? Like that's,
oh my God.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
I was expecting to hear that.
Right? But that was, that was the version of self at the time. And I think I got that from my mom. I think I got that from my sister. I think we were all sort of like, and again, I cannot speak for them, obviously, right? But that was, as I reflect on it, that's what I think, if I have to theorize, that's what I think was happening. And we straight, like, I didn't really get into, I think a little bit of this was also around my mom defending me from sort of things that were too sexual. So it's like, no Prince. We didn't listen. We didn't have Purple Rain in my house. We had Michael Jackson, ironically. We didn't have no Prince. Ain't got no Prince. That ain't happening, right? So there's a little bit of that as well, because I think black music, especially in the 80s, was more sensual. It was more sexual. So I think that was being curbed a little as well, if I'm honest. So yeah, so as you go throughout, it isn't really until college that I start to get introduced to concepts that let me start to interrogate race. So again, get to college, there's a black student union. I don't go to that. And it's Johns Hopkins, which is mostly white anyway, right? I don't feel engaged with blackness. I'm not necessarily, I'm not necessarily avoiding it, maybe just a little, but I'm not reaching, I'm definitely not reaching out to it. And the, and that's really when I started making real friends. But again, most of them are white. And again, I felt more comfortable in those white spaces. I had that weird tendency for a black man in America to feel more comfortable in white spaces, which I recognize now as unusual, but that is absolutely how I felt. And it weirdly, it isn't until much later in life. It's really, it's like, you know, those old cartoons where like the coyote like runs or on the, the coyote runs off the cliff. He's running after the roadrunner. The roadrunner goes and he runs off the cliff, and it is, and he's like walking. It's like he's walking around, and it isn't until he reads the book on gravity that he actually falls. I forget which one it is. There's like, maybe it's Daffy Duck. I forget. But in any case, it's sort of like I was out on that cliff and I didn't realize it, because like I wasn't afraid of cops. I was in Baltimore City in the 80s and I wasn't afraid of cops. Think about that for a second.
Let's pause and think about that.
And I had some run-ins where like a cop started following me for like no reason, but I was more baffled than afraid. Like that shit happened to me. Now I'd be like, oh shit, I'm going to be on a t-shirt. I'm about to be a hashtag, yo. But at the time I was just like, oh, this is weird. Why is he? And I kind of knew there was a racial element to it, but it wasn't like life threatening. It wasn't registering that way. And this, remember, this is before Rodney King, right? This is still just right around that time. So it's like, oh, oh, wow. I wonder if that's a bad egg. Again, no awareness of what every other black person in America knew. It was like, motherfucker, they've been doing this shit for 60 years. What are you, where have you been? This is just, this is the first time they got it on tape, but this is being black. So I felt more comfortable around white people. And to be fair, like most of them treated me well. So it wasn't like from my perspective, that was a normal thing, but I had not zoomed out. I really remember the first time I really started to think more deeply about this is I wrote a paper on Elvis. That was all about sort of, it was a class I was taking on revisionist history, which was one of the best things I could do, right? Because now we're asking questions like, okay, read this text, this history textbook from the North and this history textbook from the South. spot a difference, right? That was me starting to get more critical about it. And in my paper, I was writing about the complexity, I remember, of Hound Dog. So there's the song Hound Dog. It's one of Elvis's first hits. And it's like the narrative is, oh yeah, he stole that from Willie Mae Thornton. They just lifted her shit, took it, which he did. But Willie Mae Thornton, that song wasn't written by Willie Mae Thornton. That song was written by Lieber and Stoller, two Jewish guys who wrote half of all the rock anthems of the time, right? So it's like, shit is complex. That was my first introduction to shit is complex.
Right.
Race is complex. These stories, evolutions are really complex. And it's this awakening, I would say, to things are complex. Once I had room in my mind for that, that's when I could start engaging with things like blackness. And keep in mind, even then, I'm still evangelical. I'm still a Republican. Oh yeah, that happened. And it really isn't until I meet my wife, who is very much not that, that I start to open my mind and start to be exposed to these ideas. And then even a little bit after that, I really start getting into this awakening around blackness, around fairness, around justice, around what is America really, that a journey that I'm deeply entrenched in now. And the irony of all of this, by the way, is this is where my mom started. So before she became this evangelical, before she became this Republican, by the time she passed away, she was super Fox News, kind of Glenn Beck kind of like person. But before all of that, she was in like black activist groups in like Rochester, New York, right? She was running for school board, right? Like she was very, she knew the guy who invented Kwanzaa. All right. That's how into it she was.
Wow.
Yeah. Like she was like, I think in a political group with him. So like this is, so her journey, we almost took opposite journeys, right? She went from this very culturally aware, culturally active in that culture. She never really lost that political zeal. I think she just switched sides, but she was still very engaged. Whereas I went from the sort of more assimilated kind of like neutral place to this very, and eventually a republic place, to this super progressive, down with capitalism kind of place that I don't think even she was ever on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just weird. It's so weird to see that flipped journey, which on the one hand still runs from that same DNA of like, yes, I'm going to be politically active, but is also coming from this different place of, we're coming at this from completely different perspectives now.
So with everything that you said, and your upbringing that your mother made sure that you had and everything like that, was there a moment when you were realizing this where you, I don't want to say like you were upset with your mother or anything like that, but did you question like why she raised you the way she did? Like, and how was it confronting that and understanding how like the nuances that came with
that? I regret that I never got to have a real conversation with my mom about any of this. I mean, there came a point when she started going hard into the paint for Republicanism that I just couldn't have conversations with her anymore. Because I got upset. Like she was very like academic. Like she was an incredibly intelligent woman. And she loved to like just play with academics and politics. Like it was engaged. She liked having those debates. And for me, it got to the point where I couldn't listen to her say things like, oh, if Muslims moved in next door, I'd be afraid. And I was like, I can't hear that from my mother. Like, we're related. I just can't. Like, and so for me, I had to be like, for my own, I have to set a boundary here. We can talk. I love talking to you. We can't talk politics. Right. I had to lay that down with her. I had to lay that down with my sister. I was like, we can't do that. So we never really, and I don't think it was until much later, I really started to process that aspect of my upbringing to the point where I could have even concocted the question, hey, were you consciously thinking about blackness when you raised me? Were you consciously avoiding blackness when you raised me? Like, were there things that you wanted to? And honestly, like, this is my version, right? I could totally see a scenario where she's like, what are you talking about? I tried to get you to read these books about Africa. You wouldn't do it. That is totally plausible. And if that happened, and I'd be like, you know what? I could see that. Like, that's, I could totally buy that. That wasn't the kind of shit I was into. Like, but my memory of it is, I don't remember pushing that very hard, but I never got to have that conversation with her. So my reflection on that is really, like I said, it's my theorizing in retrospect. Oh, given what she had still, because keep in mind, she's not rich. She's a single mom trying to raise me and her sister and her daughter from another marriage. Working on a government salary. She worked for the Department of Human Resources, going after people who are evading child child support. Going after people who are evading child support. Like, that was her job. So that's not paying a lot. Also, for a while, having to support her mother, who is dementing, right? And at the same time, trying like hell and going into debt to make sure I was getting like a freaking private school education. Right. So she's got all that still. And I still remember like sort of walking by her room one night and just seeing her sitting on the edge of the bed crying. I will never forget that shit. So all of which to say, like, given all that she was dealing with, I applaud her. Live long day. And if she had to sacrifice my blackness for my progress, which, let's be honest, is a choice every goddamn African-American has to make every goddamn day. So be it. Like, I do not blame her for that. What I do is realize there were consequences, right? And so this is all stuff I encounter now and work through now. And I'm only just like awakening is probably the best word for it, but that I awaken through now. And I think it's funny. We talk about like how we talk. I think I overemphasize or relish opportunities to be black in the way I talk. You know what I mean? Like, I've made that more and more of my rhetoric, my rhetorical style. I lean into it more because it's like this thing you had access to that you didn't know you had access to. It's like, oh yeah, you've had this trust fund for like years now. It opened up when you were 18. You never dipped into that? No, it's right there. It's just like you open this vault and it's just black. Just blackness. All this blackness. It's like, oh yeah, you could say fitna. What do you could have been saying fitna this whole time. Yeah, it's yours. Take it. Dude, you could say the N-word. You didn't know that, did you?
Yeah, man. So when you realize, you know, your journey is it's amazing. And you being on this journey and evolving and realizing having your awakening later in life, that is to me, that's incredible. Because just hearing you talk about this, like you're very at peace and confident in talking about yourself and everything like that. And I just want to say, like, mad props in regards to that, David. So part of the thing I think is interesting in this particular journey that this podcast highlights. It's like you were called white, like why you talk white, because of how you talk, whatever, you know, right? Did that happen by, just quick question. That happen from black people and white people? Or was it
I don't remember if any white people ever called me articulate, but I'd be shocked if they didn't.
Okay.
But it was from black kids telling me that. And by the way, just as a side note, The main kid I remember saying that to me was light-skinned as hell. I have to feel like that worked its way into there a little bit. I have to feel like he was covering his ass a little bit by picking on the darker-skinned kid and saying, I'm not white, he's white. I'm just light-skinned, he's the one who's white.
So that happens, but then as you realize things, as you get older, things starting to click, being followed or maybe being looked at differently, or, you know, whatever, you develop I tell people I can sense racism. I can sense it. Mm-hmm. I can sense when something's off. It's like a black superpower. I can tell I am on
spicy
guard.
Sense. Blacky right? sense.
Yes. Blacky sense. Blacky sense. Yes. Coin new term, merch coming up, y'all. Blackie says,
"My Blackie sense is tingling."
Right, exactly. How was it navigating? like that being, you know, you being a black individual, being told you're not black, but then also coming eventually coming face to face with what it's like to be black in America, facing, you know, moments of straight up good old American racism towards black people. So how can you describe how that felt and what it's like holding that as a, you know, as a black man who has experienced the nuances that we're talking about?
So it's funny. I feel like I was spared a lot of that tension because the period I believed I was white, which is a phrase that Ta-Nehisi Coates uses, like people who believed they were white, which is just a great, great phrase. That he uses to refer to white people, by the way, like it's a great phase. But anyway, the period I believed I was white didn't overlap a lot with the period I believed I was black.
Okay.
And by the time I believed I was black, I wasn't being called white very much. Like I wasn't in that company anymore. And so I didn't really have to deal with that tension at the same time. Like it wasn't like in one day it was happening. Right. And I wasn't really engaging with parts of the black community that were offended at me. Like that didn't happen very frequently at all. I think it would be more around class at this point more than anything if I were to sort of encounter that. Cause I'm much, like I said, that journey from white to black, ironically, also was a journey from poor to rich. Right. I got, as I moved on through life, I had more and more in my bank account, right? More stability in my work and all that other stuff. And so weirdly, it's the reverse. Like weirdly, as I got richer, I got blacker, which has got, again, one of those like, that. Okay, sure. Yeah, I guess it has to happen sometimes.
Stereotypically, that is, I guarantee, I mean, and you more than anyone would be able to answer this. Yeah. I guarantee stereotypically in the viewpoint of like, what is put out to the masses every day. And that is not.
Oh, no. And it's interesting, right? Because I think that this is actually worth exploring a bit. So I am a speaker. I give talks on inclusive design. I give workshops on inclusive design. And sometimes the feedback that I get, and I'm pretty confident this is exclusively from white people, is that you present these ideas, some version or another of, you present these ideas in a non-confrontational way. Like they appreciate that. And I,
what?
Yeah. I take that as, oh, this is my white upbringing. I know how to make white people comfortable. And not even like, I know how, it's like, I just do it unconsciously. Cause that's how I was. They have adopted the whiteness. I was born into it, you know, like
molded by it.
Right. So I got that Bane shit going on. It's like, I can just blend in with the white people. And it makes it, I'll be honest, that's a superpower too. Like I can tell you, I can go on and on about anti-capitalism and fuck Facebook and get really angry about it. And you don't get scared. There's a black man on stage getting angry and you're not scared. That, my friend, is a superpower. And if you told me, okay, you got to do that, I'd be like, I don't know the fuck to do that. But if you just say, get on stage and talk about this shit. Like, so if anything came of me growing up white that is useful now, that's probably it. Right. So all of us just say, like, when I think about, that tension though, I don't know. I have yet to resolve it. I have yet to know what to do with it. And again, it isn't explicit now. So I'm not kind of forced to confront it in any way, but I will say this. I do have a little bit of imposter syndrome around being black, right? And again, that's all around the stereotypical things that black is supposed to be. But there's this invisible black person in my head saying, you're not ghetto. You know what I'm saying? Right? Like,
right,
you know,
right.
Man, you can't name enough 90s rap.
Right.
You don't know about LeVert. You know, like it's like this stupid shit, right?
Right.
You ain't never had a bean pie. Which I hadn't until like earlier this year. I'm going to be honest. I had my first bean pie in January and it was fucking delicious, but motherfucker, I hadn't had one before.
Right.
So all of it to say, so there is that, but at the end of the day, what grounds me, and this is grim, but what fucking grounds me is like, call me black, call me white. That cop stops me. My motherfucking ass is black. I don't care how I talk. I don't care what I wear. I don't care like what music I listen to or what movies I make or whatever. No. That cop stops me. I'm black. I just became black. I just became the blackest person on earth. So how do I know I'm black? I know I'm black because any white officer in this country could kill me and get away with it. That's how I know I'm black. Ain't got nothing to do with my interests. Ain't got nothing to do with how I talk. That's the truth. And so I am not at all concerned when people are like, oh, you're not black enough. Oh, really? Let's get stopped in a car and see what happens.
Definitely, man. And I think facing that is a part of being black in America. I just have a son that's about to turn one, and I dread having to have that conversation that my mom had with me when I was a kiddo, that certain things are going to happen. And my kid's also a biracial kid. And we're going to have to deal with, me and my partner are going to have to, you know, face those nuances and intricacies as well. So, you know, it's interesting navigating all of that. So let's unpack some of the details you just mentioned. You mentioned imposter syndrome about blackness. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about that, I had like this vision of like, it's like this little, this like this, your version of like another black Dave that is poofing. This is the blurred dork in me right now. Just
totally.
Hearing what you're saying, just like pop, like right here next to you. Like, and I have this animated version of you being like, like telling you like, oh, you're not black enough. You're not like just kind of like, just being, it's just crazy how like the mind and how, you know, we can put so much onto ourselves. I hope that one day we all can just understand that we all have various journeys, and we're all black and in this together, and may have different pathways and different unique ways of being black and navigating the world, but we're all trying to do the damn thing. Guess what I'm trying to say? You know what
no,
I mean?
No, totally.
Yeah. So I know we got into this a little bit ago, but like, you know, it's a shame. I just feel like, and this is something I've asked myself, because there were times in my life where I wondered that too, when people were telling me like, yeah, man, you should dress like a thug, or like, yeah, man, like, you know, other black people. Yeah, man. Like, you know, nah, man, you shouldn't do this. You should do that. Like, at times I'm like, why? Like, I just look back and I'm just like, why? Like, I'm like you said, Dave, that bullet from like a racist person who wants to deliver a hate crime, or a racist cop, like, is it ain't gonna give a damn what, you know, how we look, how we dress, yeah.
They shoot Urkel.
Wear glasses. Hey, say it again.
I was gonna say they shoot Urkel, man. Like, Urkel shows up at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
Like they ice and Urkel, and they ain't going to jail for it.
Yeah. Urkel and Stefan, it doesn't matter. They're done. It's a wrap. They're done. There's
going to be on a t-shirt. Is all I'm saying.
Yeah. There's no amount of blackism that is going to save them. That's so when it, you know, even though that was just explained in a very dork fashion there, it's like, you know, I just sit back sometimes and I wonder like, look, as you said earlier, I get it. I understand like where, you know, where the quote unquote backlash and where the like, oh, are you one of us? Like where that can come from. And, but there is the, do I want to say there is the sharp now, and there is the punishment that can come from that. So in experiencing that, and I know you mentioned that, you know, right now, like, and I love that you're so confident with that. And that's a space that I hope everyone who listens to this podcast can get to, that, yeah, Yeah, I'm a blurred. Yeah, I'm a dork. I like anime. Oh yeah, I listen to rock. I listen to Led fucking Zeppelin. And you know what? I'm still black as ever. Like, get to stuff like that. Did you ever feel like upset? Was there ever a time, because I know you were kind of like evolving and navigating it, but was there ever a moment where you felt sad or upset about it all with all that? Does that make sense?
No, totally. And the answer is yes. I mean, I feel like I was cheated out of, and again, with like no disrespect to my mom, because I get it, but I feel like I was cheated out of that aspect of myself. Mm-hmm. And while I think there were gains I was able to get out of that, it came at a cost, and a cost that I didn't necessarily consciously choose. So I don't love that. And I feel like I'm grateful for the time now to explore that. And like even more so with my Africanness, mm-hmm. right? Which is something, and this is a whole other complicated, you know, saga, but even once I found my father, I wasn't really comfortable embracing that culture. Whereas now I'm much more into it and much more. I've never been to Africa. I would love to go. Unfortunately, yeah, right definitely. Now, Ethiopia is off limits. I hope soon it won't be. But I want to go back to Africa, man. Like even the way I phrase it, back to Africa. It's like, well, I mean, my dad was born there, but
right.
But yeah, like that even that part of it, like I wish I had been steeped in it more. I wish I had been open to it more. So there's, I think it's the pain that I feel, I think, is more of a pain of regret,
okay.
and a grieving for a childhood that wasn't. I think that's all wrapped up in there. But I think honestly now I feel excited to explore all of these things because it is hidden. It is hidden history. And right. I feel even more excited that it's something my son is getting exposed to for free, right? So have you heard of Mansu Masa or Mansa Masu, I think his name is.
Okay. Oh,
you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. The richest man of all time.
Yeah. When did you learn about him? When did you learn
Mansa
about him?
Mansa Musa. Through actually crazy, I think through social media, and I just did a deep dive. I did a deep dive into him. Just to, you know, since you're a filmmaker, once you're, I'll ask you a question about your project in a bit.
Sure.
Once you blow up, just remember this and please do what you can, because I am sick. This is Dork JV film maniac JV coming out right now. So I just want to say this.
Yeah.
I am sick of, you know, there's only so many damn slavery movies that is for black culture. I get it, but damn, like we need more black heroes, more historical, actual black.
There are so many. There are so many.
How there hasn't been a movie. And I'm not talking about a TV show. I'm not talking about how there has not been a big budget, $150 million budget movie about Mansa Musa is fucking insane to me. It is insane. The fact that has not been made yet, or the fact that we are not hearing more about a movie like that being in development. That is about pure greatness of humanity, and it needs to be told. I just wanted to get that ran out. So
yeah, yes. I'm gonna leave it for people to go. But understand, this brother was so rich as he moved through Africa. I think it was on his Hajj, but as he moved through Africa, giving out gold, he wrecked economies with how much gold he was giving out.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Anyway, I didn't learn about that brother until I was in my 40s. My son learned about it in eighth grade.
Okay.
So that's progress. Right. That's awesome. And that's a question I always sort of ask myself, like, what does progress mean for Black Americans? That is a version of it, I believe. But so I'm like so happy about that. I'm so happy that he is getting, and you may discover this with your child, but like there is a joy in your child receiving the thing you didn't get.
Yeah.
There's just and to be honest, a little bit of jealousy, but mostly joy, mostly joy that they get the thing you didn't get. So absolutely.
Awesome, man. So I mentioned just right now, a little bit ago, with that crazy rant I just did about Mansa Musa, that you have a project going on. So yeah, yes. take this time.
So this is, this is, it, yeah. Get so this it. Is a good like evolution. So as a kid, like I said, I've been making movies ever since I was a kid. I knew I wanted to be a director then, but these were all just sort of like genre exercises. Like I wanted to make, you know, James Bond meets Miami Vice, 1,000 years in the future. And this is my like space saga epic and all that stuff. Like I wasn't really exploring anything. I just wanted to make action movies, these exciting movies, like, you know, by the time you get to, you know, where I am now, it's sort of like, oh, as I learn a more about movie making as this thing that has subtext, that movies can be, have meaning above and beyond just a good time. Right. I'm starting to flow that in. And then you get to this like cultural awakening I have, you get to a movie like the one I'm making now. So the premise of this movie is that underneath Washington Square Park in Philadelphia are buried the bodies of hundreds of enslaved people. And this is true. What if one night they all come back from the dead as zombies, but they only eat white people? So the movie is called White Meat. And I've been working on it for a while now. We are doing a Kickstarter campaign in Black History Month 2025 to raise money to make a short called White Meat Appetizer that's going to get us attention for the feature. Whitemeatmovie.com/help if you're interested in helping out. And we're asking people to pledge now so that on day one we launch with a really big number. So you can make that pledge now and that makes it easier for us. So please, whitemeatmovie.com/help, make it happen. But yeah, so that is a movie where I'm taking this zombie premise. Like I love genre movies. But now what I'm doing is saying, okay, I want to infuse meaning here. I want to make a zombie movie that means something, that has purpose, that has a deeper meaning for me. And I think that's a reflection of how I've evolved, like how I've like what gives me purpose, right? Above and beyond just, oh, I want to make a fun movie. I do want to make a fun movie. And I will have failed if it's not fun, but I feel I will also have failed if it isn't resonant, right? If I'm not pulling on these strings that are like, hey, here's some shit that really happened, and here's what would happen if blah, blah, blah. Right. So I feel like that I'm kind of glad I wasn't a success early in life with my movies. Because then I think I would have been more shallow and made shallower movies. I kind of like that it's taken this long because I feel like I'm ready now to make better films. And hopefully that is going to coincide with the opportunity to make those movies. It's sort of like I've arrived at a moment where I'm worthy is not exactly the word I'd use, but more worthy, more I'm able to give a more worthy effort now than I necessarily was when I was separated from my blackness, when I was really not deep yet.
Mm-hmm. So David, what is some of your influences for this new project and this new movie, White Meat? What are some of your favorite horror movies and what can we in the future expect to see some influences of in this eventual film?
Absolutely. So this is the first thing you're going to notice is like the look and the feel of the film is heavily influenced by like classic black horror films. One of the movies that really was an eye-opener for me is a documentary called Horror Noir, which you can find on Shudder, a lot of other places, and it's just the history of black horror. And it's fantastic. And we were lucky enough to get the makeup artist from that movie is actually the makeup artist for our short. Her name is Free Howard. She's amazing. When you watch the Kickstarter video, she made some fake thumbs that play a pivotal role in the Kickstarter video. Anyway, so Horror Noir, so that interests me in movies like Blackula, which I didn't take seriously before, but when you watch it, like, oh, wait, this is actually the story of a black prince, an African prince who tries to end slavery and meets the wrong count, Dracula, and gets fucked over for it. But that's like first 5 minutes. How many movies in the first five minutes you got an African prince trying to end slavery? Right. One, this one, right? So this was an interesting period where like blackness was being centered and in some stereotypical ways, sure, but this is really our first time at bat. We get to tell our own stories with relatively, right, mid-budget movies, right? Because due to a lot of reasons, studios were like, oh, there's an opportunity here. These black audiences are going to want this stuff. And they were given, like, William Crane ends up being the first black horror director because of that. So, but there's a look and a feel to these movies as well. So the blaxploitation films like Cleopatra Jones, and which is another one where it's like, yo, this movie starts with a black lady getting off a helicopter and dignitaries from all over the world are being deferential as hell to her. Tell me how many movies start like that, right? So anyway, like that look and feel is something you're going to see a lot of. You're also going to see sort of culturally the history of zombie movies, like the earliest zombie movies were movies like White Zombie from 1932, Revolt of the Zombies, where I walked with a zombie. And in all of those movies, it's about a bunch of white explorers going to a savage land, right? Like Haiti or Angkor Wat. And they encounter these zombies, right? But the zombies are not like meat flesh-eating like ghouls. They are possessed. They are basically under a spell, raised from the dead to do labor. Labor. White Zombie is about a white guy who basically pulls bodies from the dead in Haiti and makes them work on his plantation. You cannot make this shit up.
Wow.
Right? So there's a line in Revolt of the Zombies, which is about an army of zombies that are being used to basically be military because they're unkillable. And there's a bunch of white generals at the beginning of the movie who are like, this could mean the end of the white race. Literally a line in that movie. I am not kidding you. This is like a 1930s movie. It's like, yep, he just said that. Right? So zombies have always been political. So you're going to see callbacks. You're going to see callbacks to like all the sort of Night of the Living Dead, like all the standard, but you can also see callbacks to this, like this ancient history of zombie movies that we're not so familiar with that harken back to a very different political history of zombies, because that's where the word zombie comes from. It was a Santo Domingo word for basically a person, a black person who died and has been, and whose corpse has been reanimated and possessed by a white wizard to do their bidding. So there's a huge political history. But again, from a film perspective, like I went back and I watched all these old zombie movies that predate Night of the Living Dead, where the zombie is this slave, basically. So that was kind of fascinating. So you're gonna see that influence. And then, yeah, like the modern history of black horror from like New Candyman, Old Candyman, Tales from the Hood, like all that stuff we're pulling from the hood. Right? Yo, right? Like that's, there's some tight stuff in there. So that became basically when I spent about 2 years researching before I wrote the script. And those 2 years were both watching movies, reading books. So there's a great book called The Half Has Never Been Told, which really gets to the economic story of slavery and how you don't get America without slavery. Mm-hmm. There's brilliant stuff. And again, stuff gets pulled from there and gets into the movie. And also just a geographic research, like moving around Old City in Philadelphia and seeing all these spots where slavery happened, where anti-slavery happened. Washington Square Park used to be Congo Park, which was a gathering spot for free black people and enslaved black people. I mean, there's just so much rich history here. And again, a lot of that gets you to a lot of the, you're going to see it in the geography of the movie, like the places we film. We film in Washington Square. So, you know, obviously Washington Square plays a big role, but we filmed the Kickstarter video in Washington Square. So when that comes out, you're going to see all that. But what was interesting though, for me, was by doing all this research and watching all these movies, and I got together with a bunch of brothers, and I'm like, right, what movie should I watch? What book should I read? What album should I listen to? Right. Mm-hmm. Watching all these movies, I became a horror fan, right? Like my favorite genre is action. And I think my second favorite used to be like maybe sci-fi. My second favorite genre now is horror, like straight up. I just became a horror fan by watching all these horror films and realizing how versatile the genre is. Like you can do anything with horror. There's something really flexible about the genre. It's like you can have horror that is romantic. You can have horror that is dramatic. You can have horror that is funny. You can have horror that is sad. You can have horror that is happy. You can have horror that is a mystery. Horror sort of takes all comers genre-wise. And you can sort of do that with other genres, but like horror seems to be able, and you can have horror that is political. You have horror that's social, right? And so in fact, it's almost kind of hard to have horror that isn't political. Like there's just something about it. Because you're dealing with this basic human emotion of fear. And what, and it's fear is very dimensional, right? And so like, I really, really, really love horror now. And I love kind of exploring it, but those I think are some of the big influences I think about. And the other movie I really want to mention here, cause it's not very well known. So the main character in this movie is a woman named Sarunya. And Sarunya is basically your kind of typical underappreciated black woman in tech who like, oh, she just got a promotion, but she didn't get a raise, like shit like that. So she's out celebrating that. And on the night that all of this happens, and she's put in the position, and again, going back to what we were talking about before, being the one black friend in the white group, she's put in the position of being, oh, when the zombies are attacking my white friends, they won't go past me. So it's now literally my job to help them navigate blackness it was my job socially to help them navigate blackness before. Now I'm literally doing it. And it's like, all right, is this really on me? Like, right? Like, so all of that, we get to explore all of that. But that name, Sarunya, comes from an African film about a real African queen. Going back to that, let's talk about our African heroes. A real African queen who defeated the French in what is now Niger, back in, I think, the 1800s. But yeah, it's a fantastic film. And it's great because she's like, talk about like getting it from both sides. She's got to deal with the French, but also because she's an African queen, all the male black tribes around her are Muslim and are pissed she's not Muslim. And so they're not giving her any help. She got to take it from them. And so she got to take it from the black people and she got to take it from the white people. And lady don't take no. So she's got to take them all. But it's a fantastic film. You can find it like on YouTube if you do a little digging. But I was like, oh, I'm having that. Like, that's the name of my character, Sarunya. Like, yes.
Wow. So I love hearing all the details and the influences that are going to be going into your project, White Meat. And I also want to say, love how you're including the wonderful city of Philadelphia and highlighting the rich Black history, slave history of Philadelphia too, like telling the whole story through your film. So it sounds awesome and very excited to see how it progresses and can't wait till it comes out. Is there anything else you have to say in regards to White Meat?
No, I'm just going to like pitch again, yo. Like, so the way it works is we're doing this thing called pre-crowdfunding. The way it works is, I only just learned this now. Like, that's the other thing. I'm learning constantly while we're making this. So I learned that if you do a Kickstarter campaign, any kind of crowdfunding, the amount you raise on day one influences how much you're going to raise in the West. So if you can raise at least a third of your goal on day one, you are much more likely to hit your goal because people look and they're like, oh, yo, look how much you raised on day one. All right, this must be for real. I'm going to contribute, right? Otherwise, it's like, oh, you only made $2 on day one. I don't know if this is for real. I ain't going to put money in that. So it's momentum. It's marketing. And the way you get to that goal, that 30% is, you have people pledge, okay, I'm going to be there on day one. And this is how much I'm going to give. And you tell people, these are the rewards we're going to get. So like you give that much day one, great. So we've raised so far about 16K of people who've pledged on day one, I'm going to give 16K. We're trying to get closer to 20 or 30. So between now and Black History Month, contribute, whitemeatmovie.com/help. You're going to see a big ass link there. If you don't got the cash, there's like 15 other ways to help on that page. But that's what I'm going to keep hammering home. Whitemeatmovie.com/help.
Awesome, man. What in your wildest dreams, or just in general as a creator and filmmaker, do you want this movie to accomplish to its audience?
So I'm going to be arrogant and say, I want to be the first Black director to win Best Director.
Woo! I love it. Speaking into it.
Now, I don't want to be that because it's going to take like 3-4 more years to make this movie. And we damn sure better have a Black director win Best Black Director before then, because what the fuck? But if they still ain't doing it, I'll do it.
Love it.
No, I would love that. And the thing is, I've learned to like dream big with this, because let me just say something. Terrifier 3, which is an indie, extremely gory horror film, just opened number one a couple weeks ago. And beat out like the second week of Joker Folia Deux, third, fourth week of Beetlejuice, like all these like big ass movies. This thing was from a production company nobody's ever heard of. Oh, went out unrated. Like all the rules that are supposed to be like, oh yeah. Like I'm sure you'll have your nice little fun. You're not going to make number one. It opened to 20 million, number one, and they're projecting 50, 60 million. And this is a movie that cost 2.5 million. All right. So that's the rules are off. The rules are gone, man. I don't even know. So I'm not going to limit myself at this point. Be like, yeah, sure. A horror movie about Black zombies eating white people. When's the best picture? Why the fuck not? I don't know.
Why not?
Sure.
Why not?
So I'll dream big. But in terms like culturally, what I want people to explore their history. I want people to just, I want us to reckon with slavery. I want us to reckon with genocide. I want us to just fucking accept we stole this country and then we stole people to fund this country. Like, that's not cool. We've done a lot of cool shit. I will grant you that, but understand we founded this shit as a house, this is a home invasion and a kidnapping, right? That is how we founded this shit. We have to deal with that. And the longer we don't deal with it, the more fucked up it's going to get. Like, that is the very blatant subtext, quote unquote, of this movie, because you try to bury shit and now the shit is coming back out again, right? Is that subtle enough, right? So I think I want us to have the grace and the fortitude to really deal with this shit, Because I think so much of our problems come from us just really not wanting to deal with it and wanting to kick the can down the road. I feel like living in the 2020s is like walking along a road and you get to the end of the road and there's all these cans. And you're like, where'd all these fucking cans come from? Oh, right. We've been kicking them down the road for 200 years. Yeah, guess what? Now there's a big fucking pile of cans. You can say that's global warming. You can say it's race relations, transgender related, like all of the things is shit. We've just been, we'll deal with it tomorrow. We'll deal with it tomorrow. We'll deal with it tomorrow. Like, motherfucker, we have to deal with it now. So yeah, I want to engage with that history. I really, really want people to do that. And I've planted these little Easter eggs in the movie. So some stuff is explicit. I'm like, oh, there's a scene in the movie where one of the characters tells the story of the black people in Haiti fighting back Napoleon, which is a great story. Again, it's one of those like, yo, we don't know that history. You think Haitians right now, you're thinking, oh, people eating that cats and dogs. No, motherfucker, when you think Haitians, think people who defeated Napoleon twice.
Opening twice. A can of ass, man. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right? And of all those revolutions at the time, it's the only one that actually was a successful revolution. Mm-hmm. Then just end up with more white people in charge, right? So yeah, like, so there's more, but then there's little Easter eggs, right? There's a scene where they're being chased by zombies through what's called the president's house, which is in downtown Philly. And it's basically the outline of where the president used to live when he would visit Philadelphia, because that used to be the capital. And then there is in the background of one of the scenes, just keep an eye out for this now, right? If when the movie comes out, a sign says Oni escapes, right? Oni escapes. You're going to see that right in the background as someone's like trying to dodge a zombie. Oni is Oni Judge. Ona Judge was a slave that was owned, enslaved woman that was owned by George Washington and Martha Washington. She realized she was about to get sold to, I think, Martha Washington as a wedding gift for Martha Washington's like daughter's wedding gift. And she was like, nope. And she left. She escaped from that house in Philadelphia. And George Washington spent the rest of his life trying to get her back and he failed. She died free.
Damn.
That's the kind of but that's one like you got to Google that shit, and I'm banking on the fact that we've trained audiences now to notice stuff and be like, oh, that means something. They lingered on that. That means something, right? And you know, to this day, every time a Marvel movie comes out, within 24 hours, there is a big ass article, 50 big ass articles of like 50 Easter eggs from the new Thor movie. It's like, yep, that's right. That's right, goddammit. Like, yep, so that would be like, yo, 50 Easter eggs from white meat. Like, boom, 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 boom. And it's all like, oh, now you know your history, motherfucker.
I love it. I love it, man. That's incredible. And I just can't wait to see it. And I'm very excited for you and your team in regards to this project. And, you know, with that said, earlier you were talking about kicking the can and everything like that. I feel like that's something that being a guest on this podcast and telling your story on this podcast, that's adding to stories and experiences that need to be told and need to be seen, not just in the Black community, but other communities as well, so we can just better understand each other and better see and be more empathetic towards one another and understand that there's not just one singular way of being Black. There's different Black journeys. There's different Black thoughts. There's different Black mannerisms. There's different pathways and everything like that. And every one of our Black selves is on a path that we're just trying to find ourselves in. So I want to thank you for, you know, being on this podcast. Thank you for being you. Thank you for, you know, being your badass self and for doing what you do in your work life, in your creative life, and just in general. So I just want to give you your flowers. That was my phone. Give you your flowers in regards to that. And, you know, thank you very much, Dave.
I want to thank you for having this podcast, because I get to come on here and talk about shit I don't get to talk about anywhere. Like, ain't nobody asked me about this. And as soon as you told me the premise, I'm like, okay, I've got to, this is my only chance to tell the story. So like, whether you like it or not, I'm coming on your podcast. because I've told people about this, and like, as I've told people about this, like, some people have just been like, oh, yo, sign me up. Tell them I went on and I'm going to give you those names. But I'm realizing shit. Do I know any Black people who are quote unquote Black, like stereotypical Black? I don't. Like, I think the majority of Black people are Black in their own unique way. Cause of course they are. Cause we're not a monolith. Right. So I think that's what I believe. You want to talk about the ambitions for my movie? My ambitions for your podcast is this opens up a necessary conversation. This opens our eyes to, wait, we're all different Black. Cause of course we are.
right?
Right.
But everybody I know is some version. They have some aspects that are like traditionally black, and they have some aspects that are like, I don't even know where the fuck that comes from.
Right.
Like, right. I've told, like, the people involved in this project, a lot of them are black nerds, right? Like, it's right. Like, there is this, and they have their own unique way of being black. And I think the only similar thing they face, and I think this is why we're trained to think of ourselves as a monolith, is the oppression, right?
Yes.
No matter how differently they exist in their blackness, they get stopped by that cop.
Yep.
They all become one black person, right? One black person with 1,000 faces, right? But when they're not in that position, where they're not being actively oppressed, when they're not being gazed upon in that way, when they could just be themselves, like I can be on this podcast, now we are us, right? And I think, I cannot tell you how happy I am doing this. I cannot tell you how much I wish you the best of luck with it. And I will be just wrangling. You're just going to have just people knocking on your door. It's like, yo, I want to be, Dave told me about your podcast. Yo, get me on that shit. So yeah, like you have helped open my eyes to the fact that it's sort of like, oh no, wait, like that little black voice, that stereotypical black voice saying be more black. It's like that isn't, that's the thing that's fantasy. That's the thing that's not real.
Exactly. Exactly, man. For sure. Thank you very much and appreciate all the kind words. And yes, the other experience and this podcast is the goal of this podcast. And I really appreciate you for coming on, man.
My pleasure, man. Thanks so much.